The deadline for a final agreement with Iran over its nuclear program is June 30th. In the meantime, the U.S. and world powers are continuing to hash out details, and Congress is working on a bill that would give it final say on any deal.
Here with us now to talk about the negotiations is U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson. He's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, Veronica. Hello, Rob. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, you've been critical of the president's framework nuclear agreement with Iran. What are your biggest concerns with it?
Well, we need to take a look at just the discrepancies between the Ayatollah and President Obama and his administration in terms of the framework of the deal. The administration says the sanctions would be lifted only once Iran complies with a large part of the deal. The Ayatollah says, no, they're going to be lifted immediately. When the administration says, well, we're going to have full power of inspections, the Ayatollah goes, well, certainly not on a military basis. And let's face it, if you're going to weaponize and create a nuclear weapon, you can do that on a military basis. And when the administration says that they're going to ship 10,000 kilograms of enriched uranium outside Iran, the Ayatollah says, no, we're not. We're going to keep that here. So, it's also been deceptive. The administration talks about any kind of deal will ensure that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. There's no such thing as a nuclear uranium or peaceful uranium enrichment program in Iran. If they want peaceful nuclear power, they can purchase that on the outside. The only reason they're putting up with the sanctions, the isolation, the economic harm to their country and their people is because they want that nuclear weapon as blackmail. And when the administration talks about snapbacks of sanctions, once they're relaxed, once they're lifted, once tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars of investment goes into Iran, you're not going to snap back those sanctions. Those took years to really go into place and start taking effect to force Iran to the negotiating table. This is a bad deal. This doesn't prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. This paves the way for them, and also paves the way for a dramatic proliferation in the Middle East. So, Americans, Wisconsinites just have to ask themselves the question, what would the world look like? What would the Middle East look like with Iran with a nuclear weapon and potentially ballistic missile technology as well? This is very dangerous. I've been sitting back in Oshkosh before I ever entered this political realm, hearing members of both parties say that we cannot let Iran get a nuclear weapon and all options on the table. Well, this deal allows Iran to eventually become a nuclear power.
So you've called this a bad deal. What does a better deal look like to you? If you want to stick with the negotiations and come up with something else, what looks better?
Well, first of all, we should have, once we realized Iran was not negotiating in good faith, we should have strengthened sanctions and brought them to a negotiating table when they finally would start complying with UN resolutions that date back to 2006, which were put in place and put sanctions in place. And the only way those things are going to be lifted is if Iran suspended or halted their nuclear enrichment. And that's the point I've been making, is these negotiations were lost from the start when President Obama relaxed sanctions. And really, that was pretty important for Iran's economy. It was worth billions of dollars. And at the same time, acknowledged Iran's right to enrich uranium. So now what we're talking about is already relaxed sanctions, and now we're just arguing how many centrifuges are going to be allowed to spin and what the quality of those centrifuges are. And again, so this is so far from what was contemplated with a negotiation to prevent them from getting a weapon, so far from what was contemplated when those UN resolutions were passed multiple times since 2006.
Well, as far as lifting the sanctions goes, the president has made the case that an Iran with an economy that's recovering, that's more integrated with the world economy, would be a safer Iran, one that's more likely to behave according to international norms. What do you say to that?
Look at how they're behaving now. I mean, they are growing in influence. They are really, pretty well controlling about five different capitals, in Beirut and in Damascus and Baghdad and, of course, Tehran and Sana'a in Yemen. So you have to look at their actions. They're trying to supply weaponry to Yemen. So Iran is going to become more dangerous. They're the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. They have an ideology that's apocalyptic in nature. So they're not going to be less dangerous when they're more economically powerful. They're going to be more dangerous. And they're going to be more dangerous when they are a nuclear power.
So you don't like this deal. You'd like to see different things included, but a lot of the details are still to be hammered out. What do you see as viable alternatives to negotiating a deal should the negotiations fail? What's left on the table?
Well, first of all, the first thing I'm asking, again, we don't know what the final deal is. I'll first acknowledge that. Right now on the floor of the Senate, we're dealing with a bill that would involve Congress or really the American people to some extent. Right now, this president, I would say arrogantly, has not involved the Congress whatsoever. He's saying this is just an executive agreement. You know, from my standpoint, I think the American people need to be involved in determining whether this is a good deal or a bad deal through their elected representatives. I think it rises to the level of a treaty, which would require 67 senators to ratify that treaty. But that was defeated in the Senate. Fair enough. The other amendment I'm insisting on would be the lowest possible threshold of an affirmative vote of approval, which would just be a congressional executive agreement with expedited procedures, which would allow or which would require both chambers to just have a majority vote in favor of the agreement. As the bill stands right now, what would happen is this deal would basically be approved by the Senate and by Congress with just a majority vote in the House and only 34 senators basically voting to approve this deal. I do not think that is the type of advice and consent that our founders really contemplated when they wrote Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, which allowed the president to negotiate a deal, but only ratified based on the advice and consent of two-thirds of the Senate.
And stepping back from Congress's role in this, this bill is still in the works. I'm going to take you back to that question. What should the United States do if these negotiations fall apart?
What we should have done is we should have ratcheted up sanctions when we realized Iran was not negotiating good faith. But that's the problem, is President Obama lost the negotiations from the get-go, from the start, by relaxing sanctions and acknowledging Iran's right to enrich uranium. The UN resolutions calls for them to suspend and halt, and I think all the world powers really thought at the beginning of those negotiations is we first suspend enrichment of uranium in Iran, and then we dismantle their capability. That's what happened to Gaddafi in Libya. Eventually, Gaddafi realized, you know, it's not worth the economic pain, the isolation, the threat potentially of having my regime taken out by the United States, the world powers, because I have a nuclear capability. So he dismantles his nuclear capability. That's what we really should have been demanding of Iran, and we should have continued to ratchet up sanctions, increase the pain to the regime until they finally decided to dismantle and enter the world economy as a normal country.
Well, according to an ABC News Washington Post poll, 59% of Americans support an agreement with Iran, compared with 31% who don't. And there has been reluctance among Americans and U.S. military to get further involved in the Middle East. So failing military intervention, what about the Americans who want this agreement with Iran? As a senator, do you want to represent that majority
Sure.
of people?
I want to deal with Iran. You know, I fervently want a deal with Iran, but a good deal, one that dismantles their nuclear capability, that does not put them on a path for a nuclear weapon. The current deal that's being described to us puts Iran on the path to become a nuclear power. And again, I'm just asking the listeners to think about what that means for regional peace and world peace, particularly when you combine that with the fact that they are improving their ballistic missile capabilities as well. So I absolutely want a deal, but unfortunately we have a president that has no clue how to negotiate, and as a result he lost the negotiation from the get-go, so he's basically allowed them to continue to enrich uranium, and now we're just talking about how quickly can they break out. We're arguing over what we can actually inspect. I mean, think about that. These aren't anywhere, anytime inspections. These are inspections that are basically going to be governed by the regime in Iran. Are the military bases totally off limit? I mean, again, this is such a bad deal. I'm for a good deal, and I think when you hear that polling, I think Americans are assuming, those 59% are assuming, well, yeah, it has to be a good deal. It's got to be a deal that actually prevents Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. That's not what's being talked about here with this deal.
So you want a deal. What specifically would you like to see in that deal?
The dismantling of the Iran enrichment program. That's what we have to demand. Anything short of that continues to place Iran on a path to become a nuclear power with all that, you know, harm that results in that. Proliferation within the other Arab states. I mean, we're already hearing how Saudi Arabia is talking about Pakistan, about delivering a nuclear package from Pakistan's capabilities. This is going to be terrible for the region. So, you know, the deal has got to be a dismantlement of Iran's ability to become a nuclear power.
And the president has said time and time again that the inspections will be present, will create safety should Iran want to make a break for a bomb. Why aren't you satisfied with inspections?
Because they're not going to be the type of inspections that could actually be verifiable and hold Iran accountable. I mean, even the Secretary of State acknowledges the fact that we don't have the right to go onto military bases. You know, you'd have to go through some convoluted process of getting international approval, bottom line, they'll be able to continue to proceed with their nuclear capabilities, their weaponization program on the military bases, and it's just not a verifiable or accountable inspection regime as it's being described to us. Yeah, I'm all for anywhere, anytime type of inspections where we would be reasonably assured that they're not cheating. That's not what's being described, and it certainly is not what's being described by the Ayatollahs.
Now, the details of this agreement, as we've said, they're still being hammered out, and Congress is at work on a bill that would require congressional approval of an Iran agreement. You offered an amendment that would make the agreement a treaty. That would mean a two-thirds approval. And that failed in the Senate earlier this week. Why did you put that amendment forward when it would alienate Democrats, raise the likelihood of a veto at a time when bipartisan support is needed in Congress?
Because the approval process in the bill on the floor right now only requires a majority vote in the House. And when you work the process through, because it's a vote of disapproval is what we're talking about. It's not a vote of approval, it's a vote of disapproval. So that would require 60 senators to disapprove, and then President Obama would veto that, and then we'd need two-thirds of the Senate, 67 senators to disapprove, and we need two-thirds of the House to disapprove. And so bottom line, it's turning advice and consent on its head, and a really bad deal with Iran could be approved basically with only 34 votes in the Senate.
No. You know,
so that's really not approval. That is not the minimum level. So the other amendment that I'm insisting on would be the minimum threshold of an affirmative vote of approval. So that would be a congressional executive agreement that would have to be approved by both chambers of Congress with just a majority vote. I think that's the minimum input the American people ought to have through their elected representatives as to whether or not this is a good deal or bad deal for America and for world peace.
Now, Senator, just briefly as we wrap up, Governor Scott Walker has said that if he were president, he would simply, on day one of his presidency, revoke the Iran deal if it remained within his power to do that as president. And he would do that even if U.S. allies wanted to stick with that deal. What do you think of that response?
Well, the problem is, again, that assumes snapback. And the fact of the matter is once these sanctions are lifted or dramatically relaxed, tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars of investment from around the West, around the world, would flow into Iran. And so you're not going to be able to put back in place the sanctions regime that actually brought Iran initially to the table. So once this deal is struck and implemented, there's really no going back. We started sanctioning Iran back in 2006. It really took, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 years for those sanctions to be put in place and have a large enough effect to force Iran to the negotiating table. And that, again, that is what President Obama took that pressure off. He relaxed those sanctions. Billions of dollars are now flowing to Iran. Tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars more would flow into Iran, strengthening their economy, increasing their ability and capability of spreading terror around the world, putting them on a path to become a nuclear power. You can't snap back sanctions. You can't reinstitute this deal.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.
We've been talking to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about international negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. Obesity affects more than a third of American adults, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It also costs us. In 2008, medical care costs for obesity in the United States were about $147 billion.
Our next guest decided to publicly share his decision to change things for himself. At 536 pounds, he decided enough was enough. He's working with a nutritionist, a therapist, and a physical therapist to help lose weight and regain his health, and he's sharing his story day by day in his newspaper column and blog, kicked off with the piece headlined, One Man's Battle to Go From Fat to Fit. Daniel Finney joins us now to talk about his journey. He's the city columnist for the Des Moines Register. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the turning point for you. You weighed, as I understand it, 563 pounds. You say you'd been obese for years. What made you decide you needed to change? What started this effort?
I think rock bottom for me was one day in February. I was out recording for some series of vignettes for a column I was going to write, and I happened to be at a hospital here in Des Moines, and the pain in my back, which I had injured in late December carrying in too many groceries, was so awful, and I had so little mobility that the public relations person for the hospital offered to get me a wheelchair. And I was just so humiliated and embarrassed that I was essentially too fat to do my job. And I took the elevator down to the ground floor and sat in the lobby, and after a while I called my doctor right there in the lobby and began the process of recovery.
Now, as you say, you were embarrassed and you were humiliated. These are personal issues. So why did you decide to do this so publicly and share this journey with your readers?
I think that there are so many wonderful efforts to make people more comfortable with themselves in society now. You look at Bruce Jenner and This Begins or Continues a conversation about transgender people. We shouldn't be making fun of people and their life choices or who they are or what they are. But for fat people, it's still okay to make fun of fat people and to treat them with scorn. I've been made fun of. Children have called me fatty. I live on a busy street in Des Moines, and when I cross the street to go to the coffee shop, sometimes people will yell out at me. I have friends who will post on their Facebook page, you know, photos of obese people, you know on scooters going through drive-through and say, you know, awful or mean things about the obese. And I guess it's not a revelation that I'm obese. You can look at me and that's obvious. I just wanted to tell the story of what it's like to live with that and to try to recover from that.
Now, you mentioned the stigma, people at random on the street yelling at you. Is that a motivating factor for you to lose weight, or does it just increase the depression, the anxiety that are part of the cause of excess weight in the first place?
Those are the kinds of things that since I've started doing this and writing about trying to lose weight and recover and work on the mental health issues that tie into this. But those are the kinds of things where I realized what I had been doing for years is I've been hiding. I have not gone to events. I have not been in public as little as possible. And I'm an introvert, so I don't know that I would always be the guy who wanted to go to the party after work or, you know, every little event. But I know that there are things that I've begged off, even like family events or smaller events with friends, because I just didn't feel comfortable enough as myself to be present. And, of course, I hated having my picture taken, and I hated seeing my own reflection in the mirror. And so they weren't motivating factors. They were just part of the, I just wanted to duck and cover.
Well, now you're doing this publicly online. I mean, real life comments can be bad enough. Internet comments can be even more horrible. But it seems like you've gotten a fair amount of supportive and positive response since you started writing this.
It is perhaps the most spectacular result of this project that I haven't received a single scold, a single fat joke, a single name-calling. It has been hundreds upon hundreds of emails and, you know, several dozen phone calls from complete strangers saying they're cheering for me or talking about their own experience or the experiences of their family members. And it is very, it's beautiful because the internet is filled with savage commentary that's often bitter and vile and cruel. And I was girded for that. I expected that would be part of the response, but it hasn't happened. Not once in 2 months or about that writing about this, and it's a little bit baffling to me, but it's very encouraging because I work in news and you work in news, and you know how people can be shielded behind their computers and their anonymity, and you know the kinds of behavior that goes on online. It's very savage, and that just hasn't happened here. It's been a very supportive, very earnest, very open environment. The only drawbacks that I saw, and these are very minor, is that occasionally people will try to sell their magic beans, so to speak, the supplement or the program that they think that will, you know, speed along the process, or maybe someone will push very hard for a surgical option or another path for me to take, but not in a particularly negative way, just they're trying to help. So, and that's, like I said, that's been beautiful.
Talking to Daniel Finney with the Des Moines Register about his public effort to lose weight, starting at 563 pounds and working his way down. Daniel, can you sum up what are the efforts? What's the plan of attack been so far?
It's three parts. First, I'm working with the physician, my regular doctor. I'm a type 2 diabetic, so I'm keeping an eye on sugars and carbohydrates and all of that. Until that, I'm working with a physical therapist to improve mediate the pain in my back from an injury that I suffered in December, carrying in too many groceries at one time. And then I'm working with my longtime mental health counselor to address the depression and anxiety that become the triggers for overeating. More specifically, what I do every day is I use an application for my smartphone called MyFitnessPal, which is free, and I use it to track my exercise, and I use it to track everything that I eat. And with the help of a nutritionist that I meet with periodically, we set goals for calories, we set goals for kinds of foods to eat, and, you know, I'm learning a lot about, you know, which vegetables have, you know, the right kinds of minerals and mixes that I need to stay healthy, and I'm trying to move more, walking, and, you know, exercise. I'm looking forward to the pool's opening so that I can do some exercises in the pool that will be high resistance but low impact, get some core strength built up. You know, what I would say to this is I'm very lucky to have insurance, and I'm very fortunate to be able to sort of assemble a team, you know, of a doctor, a physical therapist, a nutritionist, and get to them regularly and see all these things because, you know, there are a lot of people without that access, and that makes the process that much harder.
And Daniel, before we let you go, you write that you kind of want instant gratification, you want to see big results, but are you able to celebrate the small victories along the way?
Well, I mean, the first month that I did this, I lost 20 pounds, which is a big victory.
Yeah.
But it's an everyday struggle. So some days I eat more calories than I'd like, or I'm not able to move as much as I want in exercise. And some days I get very sore because my body's not used to being at work, so to speak, in terms of exercise and movement, and I get frustrated by that. But I work very hard. For example, earlier in the interview we talked about, you know, rock bottom. I worked very hard to notice things like I was out reporting a column earlier this week, and I had to climb a flight of stairs and go down a long hallway, which if I had had to do the same thing 3 months ago, I would have been in the fugue sweats and breathless by the time that I got to my destination. But I was able to do that with relative ease.
We'll leave it there. Daniel, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you.
That was Daniel Finney, city columnist for the Des Moines Register, with us to talk about his public journey to lose weight, get healthier. You can find a link to keep track of his progress at the Central Time Facebook page.